Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before I introduce this morning's speaker, I want to thank everyone for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to a virtual platform. I'm now going to turn it over to Anne Messenger, longtime TMR attendee and board member of the Central New York Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Alliance, to introduce this morning's speaker. Take it away, Anne.
Thanks, Emily. Hi, everybody. I love seeing your names on this screen in front of me and some of your faces. I wish I were here to have a cup of coffee with you, but COVID. Oh, well, I'm very grateful to Emily for turning the mic over to me for a couple of minutes because I get to introduce one of my heroes, Sarah Vanenthangamani. Imagine, if you will, you're lying in bed and your hand brushes over your leg and you feel a bump. You throw off the covers, look down, and there is a black thing on your leg. It's that bump. It's a tick. What do you do? Well, I'm about to introduce you to the man who can help you understand whether that tick is dangerous or not. Sarah Vanenthangamani is a professor with over 20 years of tick-borne disease research experience. He is one of the world's leading experts on tick-borne viruses and how they are transmitted. In 2019, SUNY Upstate was fortunate enough to discover Sarah Vanenthangamani at the University of Texas, wooed him away with the promise of building him a $6 million lab, which is in the process of being built. And he came to Syracuse, brought his 5-member team to continue his world-class work in finding out about ticks and telling us about them. I got to meet Dr. Vanenthangamani when he joined the board of the Central New York Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. We can talk more about that if you like in questions at the end. But in the meantime, I am delighted and honored to introduce you to my friend, Sarah Vanenthangamani.
Thanks, Anne. That was a nice introduction. And thanks for the invitation to share our research on the tracking the emergence of tick and tick-borne diseases in New York. I just want to kind of tell that this is a new research project that we have been doing for the past 1.5 years. So whatever we see are rather preliminary, some are advanced, but a good progress. You can actually appreciate the direction we are going. I always start with my research lab overview. My research has research portfolio is plenty in a way that we do a lot of basic science research. And from what we understand from the basic science, we then apply it to develop anti-tick vaccines, transmission blocking vaccines for viruses, and also therapeutics to control viruses as well. And we work both with ticks and mosquitoes, but today, you know, we're going to talk about ticks. And my lab primarily works on Powassan virus, Borrelia, Zika virus, Chikungunya, and West Nile. Most of the viruses that we work, or agents that we work, are a high containment pathogen, means that we have to work in a BSL level 3 laboratory. And what I'm going to talk today is basically the epidemiology and new pathogen discovery, a part of the research that we do in the lab. So before I go directly into my research or findings about our tracking our you know, tick and tick-borne disease work in New York, I want to kind of give you a brief overview about the tick-borne disease in the United States, what kind of ticks we have in New York State, and what kind of pathogens they transmit. And then I'll focus a little bit on Lyme disease and Powassan encephalitis. So this slide kind of summarizes the discovery, the timeline of discovery of tick-borne pathogens that cause human disease in the United States. So it's kind of a tick-borne diseases are not that old in a way that in the 1900s, early 1900s, Rickettsia, the agent of Rocky Mountain spotted fever was identified to be a causative agent. And then in the next, following three or four decades, most of the agents that were discovered are relapsing fever, Borrelia. And though they share the name as a Lyme disease agent, Borrelia burgdorferi, these are completely different bacteria. They cause relapsing fever, and they are transmitted by soft ticks. And then in 1958, Powassan virus was discovered. And after that, consecutively, like every decade, there was a new pathogen that was continuously being discovered. And then in 1984, Borrelia burgdorferi was identified to be the causative agent of illness that was going on in Connecticut, in the children in Connecticut. And then later, because it was originally discovered in old Lyme, Connecticut, the disease is now called Lyme disease. But the interesting aspect is that in the last 10 years, multiple tick-borne disease agents have been identified to cause disease in humans in the United States. Heartland virus, Borrelia meyonii is another Borrelia that causes Lyme disease, Borrelia miyamotoi, and Ehrlichia muris. And also there is another virus that is missing here. It's called Bourbon virus that was recently discovered as well. So that's kind of alludes to the fact that slowly the tick-borne diseases are continuing to emerge and cause serious illness in humans. So what is the status of New York State? Like what kind of diseases we have? So this is the data that I pulled out from our Department of Health. These are tick-borne diseases. Mind you, it's all reported. Not all tick-borne diseases are reported. The only tick-borne disease that is reported at this time is Powassan virus. The rest of the disease, if a clinician diagnose a patient with Lyme disease or anaplasmosis or babesiosis, they are not obligated to tell that information to the Department of Health or CDC. So if the physician doesn't reveal that information, we will not see the count here. So it stays within the hospital database. That's it, it never leaves it. But here is an average, annual average of cases like Lyme disease, almost 7,000 cases. Anaplasmosis 769, and there's an average of three Powassan virus cases each year. But again, these are just reported cases. I can guarantee you that probably almost the same numbers where they probably go unreported to the state or CDC. So ticks of importance in the New York State. I'm going to go over, three major ticks that are, that we have here in our backyard. The most common one that everybody knows is the deer ticks. It is also called black-legged tick because of the dark coloration on its legs. And the map on the right side clearly illustrates the geographical distributions. Pretty much, the eastern half of the United States actually are, they do have this deer ticks. And they transmit, everybody knows, Borrelia burgdorferi, Lyme meyonii, the causative agent of Lyme disease, Anaplasma phagocytophilum, this is the causative agent of anaplasmosis, Borrelia miyamotoi, it's a form of relapsing fever, and Ehrlichia muris, it causes ehrlichiosis, babesiosis, and of course, Powassan encephalitis. The next common one, people not completely aware, but you can actually collect these ticks very easily in our neighborhoods is Ixodes cookiae or groundhog ticks. It's also called woodchuck tick. It's the primary vector for Powassan encephalitis. The picture here clearly illustrates the difference between these two. The on the right is the deer ticks. On the left is the Ixodes cookiae. You can actually appreciate the differences in that in a cuticle. Deer ticks, they do have this typical red colored cuticle on the females, but you can see the cookiae, they are a little bit more grayish. And these ticks, they primarily feed on warm-blooded animals like groundhogs, skunks, squirrels, raccoons, foxes, weasels. And occasionally when people come in contact with the tick, they would actually feed on us and also dogs and other pets as well. The next most important tick that I think slowly emerging, it's expanding its geographical niche in New York State is actually the Lone Star tick. It is called Lone Star tick based on this characteristic dot on the back of the female. So that's why it's called, the Texas flag has a Lone Star in it. And that's how the correlation happened there. And it transmits Ehrlichia chaffeensis and Ehrlichia ewingii, the primary causative agent of ehrlichiosis. And also it transmits tularemia, Heartland virus, Bourbon, also some rash associated illness. Also people could get allergic reactions if they get bitten by this particular tick. The dog ticks are mostly, you can see in the map here, pretty much half of the United States have their dog ticks. It's called Dermacillin variabilis. It transmits tularemia and also the Rocky Mountain spotted fever agent. If you have a dog, you pretty much will have this kind of this tick in your house or in your yard easily. The dogs are a magnet for this particular tick. So I can kind of give a bird's eye view perspective of Lyme disease. I wouldn't go into the detail, but I'd be glad to answer any questions you have at the end. So Lyme disease is the most common vector-borne disease in the United States. It is caused by the bacterium Borrelia burgdorferi and rarely by Borrelia mayonii. It is transmitted to the humans through the bite of deer ticks in the eastern half of the United States. On the western half, they do have Lyme disease, but it is transmitted by a different tick called Western black-legged tick, which is otherwise called as Ixodes pacificus. They look very close, very similar to Ixodes capillaris that is commonly present in the eastern United States, but they do have a genetic differences between them. So I can actually walk you slowly on the, you know, how the Borrelia burgdorferi, the Lyme disease agent, is transmitted to humans. So when a female lays eggs, the female lays about a few thousand eggs, irrespective of the female is positive for the Borrelia burgdorferi or not, it doesn't matter because the Borrelia cannot be transmitted from a female to its offspring. So basically the transmission stops here. So eggs start as fresh. All the eggs are, they will not have Borrelia in them. When they hatch, they become larvae. When the larvae are hungry, they will go and feed on small mammals like mice or chipmunks or birds as well. And if these mice or any other animal happen to carry Borrelia burgdorferi, that Borrelia burgdorferi now gets into the larvae and it gets multiplied in the larvae. And then when this larvae molts to go into the next developmental stage, we call it nymphs. These nymphs are now positive for Lyme disease agent. And these nymphs could actually feed on smaller mammals to medium-sized mammals, like skunk and even coyotes, they can feed on them. And then once they acquire the Borrelia burgdorferi, they will carry all the way to the adult stage. Means that when a human gets in contact at this stage, these infected nymphs will transmit the Borrelia to the host, either pets or humans. And most often nymphal ticks are the ones that come in contact with the humans, but in our research, we found that both adults and nymphs equally, they actually feed on humans, cause Lyme disease. So it's a very simple life cycle. Borrelia goes through it. The only important thing is that if a female is infected with Borrelia, it will not transfer that to its offsprings. So that's one difference between this and the virus that I'm going to talk about. So this map clearly illustrates the significance of the Lyme disease and the spread. As you can see here, that pretty much the Greater Lake region and the New England region and the entire northeastern United States, they do have high prevalence of Lyme disease. So each dot in this picture represents a case in a county. And you can see the rest of the United States, there are a lot of scattered dots are everywhere, but they are not highly prevalent, but it's all concentrated in the northeastern United States and also the Greater Lake region. And on an average, CDC estimates that about 300 humans are infected and diagnosed in the United States. Again, I must warn the word here, diagnosed, because many of the Lyme disease cases go undiagnosed. So the early signs are as soon as someone gets bitten by a tick, if the tick is positive, within 3 days, they will start to show signs of illness. So the characteristic sign is the erythema migrans or the rash, bullseye rash. Pretty much 70 to 80% of the Lyme disease cases would have it. But again, there is the 20 to 30% of cases where there will be no bullseye rash, but they would have fatigue, chills, headache, muscle, and joint pain. So these are the common signs or symptoms you would observe 3 to 30 days post tick bite if that happened to carry the Borrelia. But at a later stage, like days to months, one would experience arthritis, brief bouts of pain and swelling around the joints and knees, and nervous systems symptoms include numbness, pain, nerve paralysis, even facial palsy, meningitis in some cases, severe headache and stiff neck. Rarely one would encounter Lyme carditis as well. And people could have memory loss, concentration, fatigue, headache, sleep disturbances. Again, I must emphasize here is that Lyme disease is a multi-symptomatic disease. Not everyone will present all the symptoms. It's a kind of, that's the mystery about this illness, why it is very difficult to diagnose, is that it presents myriads of clinical outcomes. As far as the treatment and vaccine goes, doxycycline and amoxicillin are the primary to-go antibiotics to control. If diagnosed at an early stage, it's very easy to treat, and most probably the patient will recover. However, if you miss that early time period, it would be, you may have long-term sequelae from that. There used to be a vaccine called Limerix vaccine. It is no longer available. The vaccine manufacturer discontinued the production in 2002, citing insufficient consumer demand. But the real reason is the company was sued by many people because of side effects. Of course, this particular vaccine doesn't give a long-term protection, which means that the vaccine's protective efficacy goes down over the time. So if you have received this Lyme vaccine before 2002, you probably no longer have or protected against the Lyme disease. But there are multiple companies now. They purchased this particular Limerix vaccine candidate. They are now making it into a robust vaccine. Hopefully in the next 5-10 years, we may have a vaccine that will be readily available for the public to take. With that, I want to kind of segue into Powassan encephalitis. I pretty much made my career by working on Powassan encephalitis when no one was working on it. So I'm kind of, you know, it's the closest. It is something that we have been working for nearly like 15 years now, and we have made a lot of seminal discoveries on this Powassan virus. I'm really excited. Every time I give a talk, I don't miss to talk about Powassan encephalitis. So Powassan virus is a flavivirus. It is a positive sense single-stranded RNA virus. It was first isolated in 1958 from the brain of a young boy who died of encephalitis in Powassan, Ontario. It's from Canada. And it's one of the two North American members of the tick-borne encephalitis virus that causes almost 30 to 40,000 human cases in Europe and Southeast Asia. And it's the closest cousin we have. So this virus was originally isolated by McLean and Donahoe in, you know, from Canada. And they did a lot of interesting similar work in those days to identify Ixodes cookii or the primary vector of this Powassan virus. That being said, in 1999, researchers from Harvard, Sam Telford and his colleagues, they identified a new tick-borne encephalitis-like virus in New England ticks. At that time, deer ticks were called Ixodes domini. But now we call it Ixodes scapularis, but at that time it was domini. So Sam Telford and others, they actually isolated this virus and they did a lot of sequencing. They were trying to identify how close this is to the Powassan virus. And they named it as a deer tick virus because they originally identified from deer ticks. So it is considered as a genetic variant of the parent Powassan virus, and it has 89% similarity in genetic sequence and 96 homology in protein sequence. Like Powassan virus, deer tick virus also cause human disease with similar or same clinical outcomes. Due to the similarity of symptoms and serological response, in vast majority of the cases, Powassan and deer tick virus cannot be differentiated in a clinical setting. So that's why we commonly collectively call Powassan virus. But when we say Powassan virus, there are two viruses within that one lineage. So that's why we call it two strains. So lineage one is this prototypical Powassan virus. Lineage two is the deer tick virus. These two viruses are transmitted by two different type of ticks as well. That is nicely illustrated here is that very, very similar to the Borrelia burgdorferi transmission cycle, deer ticks and Ixodes cookii goes through the same cycle. The one big difference here though is that when a female tick is infected with Powassan virus or deer tick virus, when it lays several thousand eggs, these eggs now have virus as well, which means that the mother tick can actually pass on the virus to the offsprings, which doesn't happen with the bacteria, it doesn't happen with the Borrelia. However, for the virus, it happens. So imagine if one female tick that is positive with the Powassan virus, if it lays eggs, one female tick now leads to several thousand larval viral infected tick. They primarily feed on smaller mammals. The larvae feeds on, you know, both Ixodes cookii and scapularis, they feed on smaller mammals. However, cookii kind of feed on several small to large size mammals like woodchucks, striped skunk, gray fox, and that's why we call it woodchuck tick as well. The cook here then actually feeds on medium size to larger mammals like elk, deer, goat, also on the moose. So these animals could actually play as a reservoir, which means that when these animals carry the virus, when the nymphal tick feed on them, they acquire the virus and then they bring on to the next stage. However, for the viruses, it's been demonstrated that when two ticks feed closely on an animal, if one tick is positive for the virus, it actually passes the virus to the next tick that they that are feeding very close to each other. So that's phenomenon we call it co-feeding transmission. It's where ticks transmit the virus to other ticks when they feed on the same close host in the close proximity. So the animal don't have to be viremic. The animal don't need to have the virus in them. It's just that one infected tick, one uninfected tick, when they feed very close to each other, they exchange the material. So that is called co-feeding transmission. That happens primarily in the tick-borne viruses. So this particular image illustrates the significance of Powassan virus expansion. So the first human case in the United States was reported from New Jersey in 1970. Within the next 30 years, it kind of spread all over the Northeastern United States and the Greater Lake region. And this overlaps with the distribution of deer ticks. So what we believe is that moving forward, Powassan virus has a propensity to expand to the Southern United States and Eastern United States. That's what we are going to see based on our experience or understanding the literature from 1970 to now. This is what we are projecting at this time. And this small graph illustrates the significance of the problem is that where Powassan virus originally discovered in 1958, for the next 30 years, there was hardly like one case per year. But from 1999 to 2007, it went to two cases per year. The next few years, it went to eight cases per year. But in the past 5 years, we are observing nearly 27 cases per year. And the 2019 number is only halfway through because we don't get the accurate number. We had to wait at least a year to actually get the correct number for the previous year because you know CDC doesn't track this information in real time. So we believe that in the coming years, it will slowly rise up. And this is an emerging tick-borne disease of concern, and it's been very well appreciated by federal agencies as well, because now they are trying to spend more attention to this virus. Very briefly, when someone gets bitten by a Powassan virus infected tick, within the first week, one would go through what we call it febrile illness, fever, sore throat, drowsiness, headache, disorientation. And sometimes when they're asymptomatic, they will recover from this. But if they are not asymptomatic, they will go to the encephalitic phase. That includes vomiting, respiratory distress, loss of coordination, speech difficulties, and sometimes paralysis and seizures. And if they are lucky to survive this encephalitic phase, they will have long-term neurological sequelae, which means that they will have memory problems, they will have severe headaches, they would exhibit symptoms very similar to Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And Powassan virus, it's a fatal neuroinvasive disease because it infects the brain. And 10 to 15% of the cases, people will actually succumb during the encephalitic phase. If they survive and go to the neurological sequelae phase, 50% of the survivors will have that, unfortunately. But some of the infection could be asymptomatic, like I mentioned before. I can show you a couple of images just to show how severe the disease is. So this is an MRI of a human case, a fatal human case upon admission on A, panel A. Panel B shows a severe inflammation in the midbrain and midbrain and cerebellum. This patient lost the consciousness and capacity for independent respiration 2 days after admission and died of day 13, died on day 13. So it's pretty fast moving virus. If the virus gets into the brain, there is a good chance that the person will succumb to the disease. So what we did in our lab does a lot of Powassan virus infection. We develop animal models to test vaccine candidates and therapeutics in smaller animals. So this is an example I'm showing. This is actually a cross-section of a brain of a mice that was infected with Powassan virus. This is day 5 post-inoculation, day 6, 7, and 8. And the color, the teal color that you see, the teal dots you see, those are viral particles. Those are individual viral particles. So you can slowly see that day five, you know, we hardly see some virus, but immediately it kind of floods the brain cells with all the viruses. And then slowly it progresses and pretty much takes over the entire brain. And as soon as the entire brain gets infected, cells start to die, the neuronal cells in the brain start to die, and that leads to the death of the animal. So it's a pretty fast progressing virus. And this Powassan virus got some sort of notoriety because the fact that a former North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan died of Powassan virus at age 66. So she actually got the virus 3 years prior to her, you know, prior to succumb to the disease. She got the virus, she went into encephalitic phase, and then she struggled for 3 years. Her quality of life was really, you know, went down for 3 years, and then she succumbed to the disease in 2019. And this kind of brought some attention to the significance of this virus, how severe the virus is. I must mention that although traditionally people know that deer ticks, dog ticks, lone star ticks are present in the New York state, however, we are now seeing this exotic tick called Haemaphysalis longicornis or longhorn tick. It is indigenous to Asia, where it is an important vector for human and animal disease agent, and it can cause hemorrhagic fever and reduction in dairy production. So both from veterinary and human standpoint, this is a terrible tick to have. And in the United States, in New Jersey, that's where they first found, I think, a sheep with tons and tons of ticks in 2017. And it's, right now, it's primarily kind of feeds on livestock, wildlife. However, we did get two ticks of Haemaphysalis longicornis that were fed on humans in the tri-state area. The significant information about this tick is that the female can lay eggs and reproduce without mating. So this particular tick doesn't require a male to reproduce. So we call it parthenogenic ticks, which means that they will actually produce a lot of female, up to 1,000 maybe found at a time on an animal. And then when thousands of these ticks, they actually feed on, let's say, sheep, it will kill the sheep. It will take all the blood. It will exsanguinate its sheep. The sheep will succumb just by the blood loss, sheer blood loss. So with that introduction, I want to kind of go on to the, you know, the important data that we have been collecting in our lab at Upstate Medical University is to track the emergence of tick and tick-borne disease in New York. But why do we do it? So our primary objectives before we started the project are to understand the impact of environmental and ecological changes on the geographical expansion of tick and tick-borne diseases. As we all know that climate change, temperature, increase in temperature would lead to longer warm season, which will then cause increase in the range of ticks and its reservoir, like mouse will be everywhere, deer will be everywhere, and that is good for the ticks to feed on them. When the range of the ticks goes means that there is more tick abundance and its activity. When there is more tick and the tick abundance is high, obviously it will lead to increase in the transmission. So that's what we wanted to see. Okay, what is the effect of this climate change in New York State on tick and tick-borne diseases? In addition to that, because my lab primarily works on Powassan virus, so we were interested in what is the prevalence of Powassan virus in New York. Also, we were interested in the polymicrobial infection of the tick. As you know, as I already mentioned, that deer ticks transmits a variety of pathogens. So we want to understand what is the prevalence of these co-infected ticks. At the end of the day, we also want to understand tick and human behavior related factors leading to the increased risk of human contact with the vectors. And then hopefully we will develop a novel countermeasure to reduce the risk of human contact with the tick vector. So that was the original objective when we started. Okay, how do we do it? So there are two ways for us to collect the information, what we need to understand the geographical expansion. One, we can do active tick surveillance, where we go to the parks, we go to the field, collect the ticks manually, and then identify them. The second part is, we call it passive tick surveillance, is where we don't do anything. We ask the public to send the ticks to us, and then we process the same thing as we do here. So that's called passive surveillance. There are two, our lab does both, but I'm gonna talk today about the data that came out of the passive surveillance. The next few slides, I'm gonna walk you through our methodology, how we exactly do this thing. Because it is multi-step, multi-people involving, it's a complicated process. I'll try my best to walk you through everything. The first stage is public tick transmission. So when someone finds a tick on their body, the first thing they start is they go to our online website. It's written here, and there are, you know, the public, then we have instructions there. All they have to do is to click the tick submission form. It opens up a form with a little bit of a questionnaire that one would take 2 to 3 minutes to fill it. You know, we would like to know when the tick was collected. Is it fresh or how did you store it? Was it on a human or not? If they say human, it opens up multiple dialogue box because we want to know where exactly the tick was actually feeding, on the human or a dog or a pet. And then we want to know the location because that's how we try to correlate the climate change and the expansion over the period of the time. And then if they want to know the results back, they would provide the email address. And then once they provide this information, a unique tick identifier would be generated. And that information, whatever the sender is actually putting in into our tick submission form, will be automatically deposited into our data server, actually. We use a REDCap software for that. Once it is done, then the submitter puts on a bubble envelope, wrapped envelope, and we have packing instructions already written clearly there, and they would put it in there, send it to our lab. And then it goes into our database as well. So what happens when we receive the ticks? So we receive the ticks in the lab, we inspect the package for any damage, and then we get the tick out. And sometimes we don't get ticks. We get skin scabs, we get spiders, we get bugs. So we try to make sure that if they are not ticks, we don't actually test them. So if they are tick, what we do, we identify the species, life stage, is it larvae, nymph, for female? Was it fully fed, partially fed? What is the condition of it? Was it dead or alive or desiccated? And then we put into our database that we manually do in our lab. We kind of identify them. We have our own way to collect information. And then as soon as we put that information, the submitter will get an automatic email saying that, hey, we have received the tick. We'll process the tick and get the results back soon. So once we finish that information, we go to the next stage is to grind the tick. We put them into a special cocktail for processing. So we put that into a special cocktail for processing. Then it goes through a machine with a small BB beads. And then it grinds the tick, it homogenizes the tick it macerates the tick into fine particles that it releases all the nucleic acid into this cocktail. And then half of that cocktail is saved in our freezer for future use, for research purposes that you will know. I think there is one example I have here to show the use of this, why we save this material. And then half of the material goes through RNA extraction. Once we get the RNAs extracted, we save half of the RNA, but the rest of the half RNA goes for tick-borne agent detection. So we are currently detecting ticks. We are testing the ticks right now for 13 different pathogens. We have it, you know, we call it mix A, mix B, mix 3. I can walk you through in the latest slides on how we do that. So once we do that information, we then compile all the data for our database. So our central database server collects 43 different data sets for each single tick that we are receiving. Some of them are provided by the submitter, like origin, location, method of collection, storage method. Was it fed on a human or not, or a dog, where it was fed? And then the rest of them are actually uploaded by us based on our analysis observation. Also the pathogen prevalence data is actually uploaded there. So from there, we use all of this data, the 43 different sets of data. Then we go and develop an interactive mapping and visual analytical tool. So this visual mapping tool is good for both research and also for the public. And you can actually, anyone can view this, and it's updated in real time, which means that if we test the tick, let's say yesterday, those data will be uploaded into our mapping software today. So that's like a 1 day lag, but we try to keep it as real time as possible. And you can go to our lab/nytickresults or nytics.org as well. You will be able to find it. I do have a few minutes to walk you through the utility, the use of this particular website. It's very interactive, very intuitive. All you have to do is to go to our lab website, go to nytickresults, and then it will come there. You just give a couple of seconds for it to fully download everything because it's a larger file. it's very user intuitive. So if you scroll your mouse over all the counties, it will actually pull some data related to that. So if I scroll here on Onondaga County, it says that we have tested 840 ticks. And then it pulls out all the information about how many ticks, what life cycle stages, what are the different ticks we have collected, and what is the pathogen prevalence as well. So I'm interested to know only Onondaga County. What I have to do is that scroll over Onondaga County, double click on the Onondaga County. Okay, so it then pulls out all the data that is prevalent only for the Onondaga County. So 30% of the ticks that we got from Onondaga County, they were positive for at least one pathogen. And you can see that it actually plots the monthly graph as well based on which month we got more ticks as well. And then if you go to the pathogen observed panel here, you can see that almost 29% of the ticks that we tested from Onondaga County, they are positive for Lyme disease agent. That's the predominant agent we have. On the species observed column, we can see what type of ticks we are collecting as well. However, if someone is interested only to know, okay, I need to know only, let's say Borrelia miyamotoi, where, in which county is Borrelia miyamotoi? All they have to do is to use the drop-down menu, select whatever agent they want to see, and then it tells exactly which county we observe the particular Borrelia miyamotoi ticks. And if you scroll over the individual county, it will tell how many ticks from that particular county were positive for Borrelia miyamotoi. So you can spend hours and hours on this to understand it. It took us nearly 4 months to build this particular dashboard. It's pretty user-friendly. You can spend enough time on it. And I know that clinicians in our area are using this to actually know what is happening in their own backyard. So when a patient comes with a tick on them, they know where to go and find, okay, if this is the tick, what is currently transmitting? So they can actually prescribe this appropriate, what is the tick testing method for that particular county. So it's pretty very useful. I'm glad to hear that the clinicians are using that. So this kind of summarizes like a visual summary of how we are testing it. So we receive the ticks in envelopes like this. We identify the each tick under microscope with a dichotomous key. We grind the tea in a system like this. And then half of the ground material goes to our freezer archive for future tick or a pathogen culture. Half of them go for RNA extraction. And then these are the quantity of real-time PCR machines that we have a proprietary method to detect the pathogen that actually specifically, we can actually detect tick-borne agents. Even if the tick has one tick-borne agent, one Borrelia in its tick, we can actually detect it. So that's how sensitive our assays are. And as soon as we get the results, it's automatically sent to the sender. Also, it goes to a central database where we create the maps. So it's a very easy process, at least this visually. So the next is the actual data. So what is the measurable outcome so far? So what the data that I'm gonna show, the first two slides are as of yesterday. The rest of them are a 1 year time period from the day we started actually. So I can tell you how things are moving on. So this is our current status as of, I think 2 days back, is that we have received ticks all over the United States pretty much, but some states are like one or two, like, but 99.9% of the ticks come from New York State because we specifically advertise this program for New York State because my budget doesn't allow to test the ticks throughout the United States. We have the willpower, manpower to do everything, but unfortunately we don't have the financial power to do that. So we try to focus so that maybe one day when we have enough funding, we can do for the entire United States. But right now we can only afford to do the New York State. So this is a bird's eye view perspective of the number of ticks we got on for the each month. So we started our tick surveillance activity in July 2019. And as soon as we started, we almost got 800 ticks in the first month of our citizen science work. And majority of the ticks, whatever the green colored ones, the deer ticks, orange ones are the dog ticks, red are lone star ticks. So these are the three major ticks that we received for our testing program. And then it went to August and September, it slowly slowly went down. That's how the seasonal abundance of the ticks are. But then in fall, it kind of picked up. Nearly we got this October and November, these 2 months, we almost got 1,000 ticks each month. And 99% of the ticks that we got in these 2 months are deer ticks. And over the winter period, you know, we got a lot of scapulary ticks, you know, adult deer ticks, where we got tons of these things, like nearly like 500 ticks we got over the winter period. And you can see that this was a warm winter, and the February 2020 was pretty snappy and cold. The number of ticks went down, and then March was a little warmer. And then again, we saw a rise in the number of ticks. It kind of correlated nicely with the weather pattern. And then now we are reaching summer, and we started to see a lot of Lone Star ticks and dog ticks, and majority of the ticks we still get are deer ticks. And then we are right now collecting the ticks. It's you know, it's not updated, but I think we are anticipating a similar trend where we will see a lot of deer ticks over the time period. But what we see is an increase in the number of Lone Star ticks. I can see that the red ones are the Lone Star. We start to see increase in the number of the Lone Star ticks, which kind of correlates to what is being what is observed by others as well, is that these Lone Star ticks are slowly moving from the southward to all the way to the northwards. And I can show you in the map in the next slide. So this kind of gives you another bird's eye perspective, the diversity and the geographic distribution of the tick species we have received. And you can appreciate that each county, the numbers in each county represents the total number of ticks we received in that county. And the small inset graph is a month-wide tick that we received over the period of the time, the total number of ticks basically. On the right, you can see the abundance of each tick. So as you saw earlier, 83% of the ticks that we have received are deer ticks, followed by 5% of Emblema Americana, which is the Lone Star ticks, and 9% of the ticks are dog ticks. So those are the majority, but again, deer ticks are the majority ones, and most of the ticks that we receive are from the Central New York area. It's primarily because of our geolocation of our laboratory and the advertisement that puts out that people are watching the news, you know, so that's pretty much why we get more ticks in and around Onondaga County. So what's the prevalence of deer ticks in our state is basically, you can see clearly that the numbers in the each county represents the total number of deer ticks we got. But I think the interesting thing is that almost 72% of the ticks that we got are females, which is the trend that we normally see, but in nature, there are more females than males. So that's what we see. Almost 12% of them are males, 72% of them females, and then 13% of them are nymphal ticks, and 2% of the larval ticks. And we got actually one egg mass, in the sense that there were the female was already laying eggs when we received that tick, basically. That's why we put as an egg there. And again, Onondaga County and the counties that are surrounding the Onondaga County are the ones that primarily are the from where we get the deer ticks. The geographic distribution of Lone Star tick, that's what I was telling that, you know, this is the dominant tick that is in the Suffolk County. It's the Suffolk County of the Long Island area. That's where most of the Lone Star ticks are coming from. And the range of the Lone Star tick encompasses the southern half of the state. And slowly we are starting to see an upward, northward, the expansion of this particular tick. Again, most of the ticks that we have received are nymphal ticks, like almost 60% of the ticks that we have received are nymphal ticks. And in here, the 48%, 22% are females, and the 15 are males here. And Ixodes cookii, although it is not a major tick of human health importance in the New York State, but they do transmit Powassan virus. That's why for us, it's pretty cool to actually see that. It is in low rates. Rarity is likely a product of its life cycle because it has to feed on wild animals, and maybe people don't encounter these things in, you know, in a realistic situation. It's not a geography restriction though. And the dog tick is on the right here that shows the uneven season submission distribution, and is highly prevalent in the Hudson Valley and the tri-state area, which is kind of surprising. I'm rather surprised that we didn't get any dog ticks from this area. However, all of those dog ticks are concentrated in the Hudson Valley, which is kind of cool and interesting. We are going to observe this information for the next few years to see why this is happening. So we get all these ticks, we identify all these ticks, what do we do with the material? So we test them. We test 13 different pathogens. Also, we have a control to make sure that anytime we grind and get the nucleic acid material, that each tick has nucleic acid material. So we need to verify that. So we do have a control for the tick. And then we kind of test using three different panels to test 13 different tick-borne agents. I'm going to highlight only the important ones now. So you can see on the panel here, these are primarily from deer ticks, almost 997 ticks that we tested in are positive for Borrelia burgdorferi. And the seasonal abundance is actually highlighted here. As expected, in the fall is where we saw most of the Lyme disease positive ticks. And it correlates to the number of ticks we are getting. However, I must mention here that for the October and November, pretty much 40 to 50% of the ticks that we received, they were positive for Lyme disease. And we are seeing the same observation now. Like I was sending out the results yesterday, 52% of the ticks that we tested yesterday were positive for Lyme disease. So this is a season where we see a high prevalence of Lyme disease. And that is correlated to with the anaplasmosis as well. This is a newly emerging, I start to see hear from the clinician as well that this anaplasmosis is slowly kind of appearing. They are diagnosing in patients as well. That kind of correlates to our tick study. And Ehrlichiosis is, we call it Ehrlichia species, and you will know why, because we still don't know which Ehrlichia this belongs to. And it's widely spread throughout the New York, but mostly prevalent in our central New York region and also Hudson Valley area. And the seasonal abundance correlates to the deer tick abundance as well. And the similar pattern was observed for Babesia microti that causes Babesiosis. Very rarely, like Borrelia miyamoto is a relapsing fever disease. There is no proper diagnostic tool, unfortunately, but doxycycline will work, like whatever that works for Lyme disease will actually help to cure this particular infection as well. And we got three Powassan virus infected ticks so far, one from the Suffolk County and another one from Hudson Valley area. And the third one is from Catskills region. But however, there are some information that when we did the active surveillance in state parks, we found more ticks actually. So we do have additional Powassan virus ticks, but unfortunately this is just passive surveillance that we received from people. And all these four ticks that we have shown here, they are actually either fed on a human or a dog. So we get ticks that are fed on multiple hosts, right? Not necessarily from humans, we get from dog. We get ticks that were fed on cat, horse, porcupine, or any other wildlife. Majority of them are, obviously they were fed on humans. 49% of the ticks are fed on humans, 18% of the ticks that were fed on dogs, and then cats came the next one, which is almost 5% of the ticks. And then when we extrapolated the information that we obtained from the human to see exactly where the tick are actually biting the human, we found that lower extremities and lower midsection area, that's where the tick likes to feed. Pretty much 38% of the ticks that we tested in that were attached to a human, they came from this particular area. Again, I must tell that we rely on the information that are provided by the user, but we believe that. And this kind of goes with our prevailing theory that ticks like to go and attach into warm, cozy places where humans normally don't go and check often. And that's probably the reason we see. And coincidentally, cats seem to be like almost 50% of the ticks that we tested that came out of the cat, they were positive for Borrelia burgdorferi. So we don't know if there is any correlation between Borrelia infected deer ticks to cat. That's something that we would like to kind of follow through to see. Is this a coincidence or is it a one-time phenomenon that we are observing? So it's an interesting data that we would like to observe. Also, as I mentioned earlier, that deer ticks can transmit many diseases, many disease-causing agents. So we were naturally interested in understanding what are the co-infections in them. And you can see that we have seen two pathogens since Borrelia burgdorferi and anaplasma in 65 ticks, Borrelia and Ehrlichia in 41 ticks, and so on. So there is a good number, nearly 3 to 4% of the ticks, they have two pathogens. And then we found three pathogens in 20 ticks, nearly 30 ticks basically of different composition. And the common denominator here is Borrelia. And strangely, we found three ticks that has Borrelia, Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, and Babesia. I'm really sorry for the person who got this tick bite. You know, they got introduced all four of this agent, as if one is not enough to cause a significant disease. So this is something that we are continuously monitoring to see observations. So it's pretty interesting for us to kind of follow through this scientifically. So the most important thing that came out of this is the hotspot identification. So we can now pinpoint exactly which zip code has a high prevalence of Borrelia positive ticks. So we get the data, nationwide data. We can then bring that to statewide data with the county level, and then to the zip code level. And then we can actually use high granularity geographic analysis to pinpoint exactly where the hotspots for Borrelia positive ticks are found in a particular county. We can apply that to each individual disease causing agents as well. So it's pretty cool for us. And we would like to share this information if any public health agency would like to know. We don't publish this information on our mapping system because we thought this is too much of private information. So we are not publishing it, but if any Department of Health agencies would like to have this data, we'll be glad to share that. So with the next few minutes, I'm gonna go over a new pathogen discovery. It's something that a cool thing that happened serendipitously, and we are excited about it. So as I mentioned earlier, we found 158 ticks containing Ehrlichia that we could not identify or correlate to existing Ehrlichia that is circulating in the United States, which means right now Ehrlichia chaffinches, Ehrlichia muris, Anaplasma, they are circulating in the United States that are grouped in Ehrlichia species, but we couldn't put anywhere these 158 ticks. We know for sure they're Ehrlichia, but we don't know what species they were. So what we did is we then actually went to a freezer where we stored half of our homogenates. We added that into cell culture. It's called macrophage cells. And then we started seeing this happening. Wherever we see the arrow marks, the pink and the green, those are the Ehrlichia. We think they are the new species of Ehrlichia. These are replicating inside. This is the cell nucleus. This is a macrophage cell. This is its cell nucleus. And the pink ones here, they are the replicating Borrelia. These are called Morulae, forming the thing. So we did that. Right now we are sequencing multiple gene fragments to completely understand what they are. And this is just to highlight, this is the Ehrlichia species that I'm talking, that we found, we consider that as a new pathogen that is currently circulating throughout the state of New York at a low number, but there are 37 ticks that we have identified so far. So with that, I'm gonna finish my last slide. I know I'm running out of time. So it is a great resource to the community because they can assess the risk and track the tick-borne disease in the neighborhood. Also, learn effective methods to control ticks and tick exposure. And it's a good resource for the clinician for developing differential diagnosis and clinical care. And it's a good resource for people like me to understand the geographical expansion, predict hotspots, develop novel countermeasures to control tick and tick-borne diseases. And with that, I would like to acknowledge my lab members and also the Moonshot team and supporting organization, of course, the ticks. Without that, we will be unemployed. With that, I'm gonna conclude. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Great, thank you so much. So the first question is, if you are in good health and have a strong immune system, does that help you defend against tick-borne disease or does that not matter?
Yes, if you have a strong immune system, definitely, you know, that will actually prevent you from getting sick actually. Because our cells, immune cells will start attacking the, let's say, Lyme disease agent or any other agent immediately as soon as it enters the body.
Great, thank you. So if you get bitten and you go to urgent care, they often want you to bring the tick with you. Do they send that tick to your lab after they treat you, or is that something that they test themselves?
We do get some ticks, few ticks from dermatology clinics, but not a lot, basically. But if it is in upstate, I know that because some of my colleagues, they will bring it directly to me and we test and give it to them right away.
Thank you. On one of your earlier slides around Lyme disease, the transmission, it looked like Massachusetts didn't have a lot of diagnoses. Is there something that they're doing to keep their cases low, or is that just they're not getting?
So Massachusetts has the policy not to share their Lyme prevalence data with CDC. So that's the reason why the entire state of Massachusetts is empty. It doesn't mean that they don't have Lyme disease. They do have a lot of Lyme disease, in fact, more than New York State. But for some reason, it is, you know, state versus federal sharing the data.
What's the first thing you should do if you think you've been bitten by a tick?
Unfortunately, I didn't cover those aspects, but I can tell you now. So if you get bitten by a tick, you pull the tick safely. I think you can go to the Central New York Lyme Alliance website. They have very good information on how to pick the tick safely, and then follow the instructions to send to my lab, and we can test the tick, what if they carry anything. We'll share the results. And I know we are not a clinical diagnosis laboratory, but I have heard from senders that they print out the email that is sent by me, bring it to their clinician, show them, look, this is the tick that bit me. Here is what the tick has. Could you prescribe me something? So, I mean, I cannot take any credit or claim for it because we are not a clinical laboratory, but I think I know that people are doing that and I'm happy for that.
Thank you. Do you support the deer calling efforts? And if so, what do you think the impact of that initiative is on the tick?
I think, yes, I do agree. As a scientist, I know that reducing the deer population will significantly reduce the tick population because, you know, the adult ticks, they like to feed on deer. Each adult tick can, lay thousands of eggs. So if we can reduce the, tick exposure to deer, we will have lesser ticks. So yes, I do agree to that.
Thank you. So you talked about that they're working on a vaccine for Lyme disease. Are there vaccines in progress for these other diseases that ticks are carrying?
Yes, we have been testing a vaccine for Powassan virus in collaboration with the University of Pennsylvania researchers. Also, our lab also developed anti-tick vaccines. So hopefully in the next few years, we will have a candidate that we can call it as a tick-borne anti-tick vaccine. For the Lyme disease vaccine, I know a couple of laboratories, I can't reveal them, unfortunately, due to the proprietary information. They are developing it, and I can tell that Upstate is doing a clinical trial as well.
So there was a question in the chat that got answered, but I wanted to bring it to everyone's attention around conducting training for physicians to recognize Lyme disease in patients, because if it's not caught right away, it can lead to other issues you talked about. Question, looks like one final question. Is the dog vaccine for Lyme effective in pets in general?
Yes, it is. I have a lab retriever and we gave Lyme vaccine. I'm happy with that.
Great, thank you. Well, this has been extremely informative. Please join me in thanking both Anne for bringing Dr. Thangamani to us, and then thank Dr. Thangamani. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me to share our data. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.